Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. Today we're going to be talking about something that is really in the headlines, not just in North America, but in Europe, and I suppose in the Southern Hemisphere too, and that's to do with this concept of fracking. That is, you know, unleashing God only knows how much of natural gases, hydrocarbons, methane into the environment that we can capture it and use it, and that's a cheap energy source for the world for, you know, quite a few decades. But it comes with a problem, and we're going to be talking about those problems and those issues today to Zach Hildenbrand, Dr. Zach Hildenbrand. He's the principal, he's the founder of Inform Environmental, LLC. It's a company in Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas. And basically, they're an analytical group that go around and examine the water table. What sort of things are in water when you dig them up from wells? Is it anything other than water? And if there are other things there, where do they come from? And what has that got to do with fracking? So, Zach, welcome to Science Studio.
Well, thanks for having me, Keith.
Before we get into the nitty-gritty of starting a company as a young man and doing analytical chemistry on water, let's learn a little bit about Zach Hildenbrand. How did you get into the science area?
Well, I got into science. I came down to the University of Texas at El Paso on a golf scholarship, actually. And as opposed to taking the normal route of a college athlete and studying a multidisciplinary degree or, let's say, history, I've always been incredibly excited about science, and so I decided to pursue a degree in biology. And it turns out one summer when I was just rehabbing from an injury, I had some extra time on my hands, and I volunteered for a biochemistry lab under the tutelage of Dr. Ricardo Bernal. And, you know, through Dr. Bernal's mentorship, I mean, I really fell in love with science. And then, you know, the rest is history. I've been pretty much captivated by, you know, the opportunity of applying new techniques and thinking critically to solving real-world problems.
But you gave up the golf scholarship.
Well, I continued. I finished up my eligibility with golf, but, you know, my aspirations of playing professionally pretty much went by the wayside. Primarily because I was struggling with an injury and I was losing my passion for the game as I once had. And then also because I had this new love and passion for science that essentially, you know, was unbounded. I mean, I viewed science as, you know, it's always an evolving process and it never really stops. And so that's what I really, really liked and I found intriguing is that my knowledge of science can continue to grow and I can learn all these new things. Again, to apply those to real-world problems and answer questions that people have. So it was really exciting for me at the time.
And the older you get in science, the more you learn. The older you get in golf, the more you dislearn.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So tell us, after your degree, you got a PhD here in the program. You went to work with EPA, is that correct? And what did you do there, and what were your sort of thoughts about that?
Yes, well, I went to work with the EPA. Again, after my PhD, I was really excited to get out into the real world, so to speak, and kind of apply the knowledge that I'd acquired in the lab. And so I took a role at the EPA monitoring and analyzing water quality in Region 6, and that's basically Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Louisiana. And it wasn't really a positive experience for me. I thought I was going to be able to, again, apply all this knowledge and think critically and develop new methods of analysis. And it was more of a bureaucratic position. And it was kind of just, you know, go with the flow. And I would like to think that I was thinking and working at a high level as I had in my PhD and to kind of have to slow down and roll with the punches, so to speak. It really wasn't for me. So from that, I went on to do a postdoc at UT Southwestern Medical Center while simultaneously starting on a research project just to, you know, on my spare time, looking at the issue of hydraulic fracturing and whether it was contaminating groundwater. So at that point in time, I was not only doing a postdoc looking at the issue of leukemia and relative cures for leukemia, but I was involved in this project with hydraulic fracturing.
So, I mean, that particular interest must have been somewhat stimulated, though, by your time at the EPA, since you were dealing with water quality, and one of the issues with fracturing is water quality. So, I mean, there was some input from the EPA experience that sort of led you in that direction?
Definitely. So, yeah, there's a number of things that I can derive from the EPA experience. And so how this all kind of came about is, me and a couple of my friends were sitting around at lunch, and we were talking about this new, at the time, it was 2011, it was a documentary that came out called Gasland. And I had never heard of Gasland, and we pulled it up on our laptop and saw some of the clips on YouTube. And, of course, you know, there's a scene there where someone is lighting their water on fire, as a function of, you know, methane migration into the water table, into the aquifer, and, you know, they're describing this as all a function of unconventional natural gas extraction or this fracking technique. And so we were talking about it a little bit and said, well, obviously, you know, they must have done tons of science to determine whether hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling and all these unconventional techniques, whether they're actually having an effect on the surrounding groundwater. And so we looked into it a little bit and thought, well, no, you know, no one has done any research into this. So we figured, well, okay, I'm a biochemist. My other friend, Brian Fontenot, he's a quantitative biologist. Another friend, Kevin Shug, he's actually a professor who I met. He's an analytical chemist. Then we had my other friend, Laura Hunt, who's a toxicologist. We figured, well, you know, this is kind of crazy, but what if we, you know, all work together on a project and, you know, it'd obviously be pro bono. We'll be doing this on our own time, on our own dime, so to speak. But what if we apply collectively our knowledge and use this multidisciplinary approach to see if, you know, hydraulic fracturing is affecting groundwater here in the Barnett Shale? I mean, the Barnett Shale is the geological region in and around the DFW Metroplex where, you know, there's thousands of natural gas wells. And they're in and around people's houses, farms, companies, and no one had ever done anything. So that was kind of the impetus for us to really get going and see, you know, what the story was in regards to the groundwater quality.
It sounds just like, you know, really good Yankee ingenuity. Although you were born in Canada, or am I wrong on that?
I was actually born in Bakersfield, California.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And then my my parents took me up to Canada at the age of one. So I would consider myself part of the Commonwealth as I spent, you know, the majority of my 18 years up there.
God save the Queen, indeed. Okay, so then you know you're sitting down, classic sitting down at lunch, digging around on the internet and finding out perhaps there's a niche for the four of you. But it takes a lot of effort to go from thinking the idea. I've been in many bars having drinks with many people and come up with all sorts of niches. And by the next morning, you know, it's all been forgotten. But in your case, you had to work on it. You did work. How do you go about putting together a company and the company now called Inform Environmental, LLC?
Well, I mean, initially when we were thinking about doing this as a study, we clearly had identified what we wanted to explore. And, you know, we looked into it a little further. You know, we determined what chemicals are used in the hydraulic fracturing process. And so...
Well, that wasn't... Hang on, let me interject, because that's not very easy, I gather. I mean...
No, it's a tremendous amount of work. And, I mean, you know, we were burning the candle at both ends. There's no doubt about that. And so, you know, I was at UT Southwestern doing my postdoc from, you know, 6 in the morning till 6 at night. And then I'd go home, have dinner, and then I'd work on this till 1, 2 in the morning in terms of experimental design. But again, we were just incredibly compelled to work on this because no one had done this. This is uncharted waters, and we've got an opportunity here to use the scientific abilities that we've been taught at school to really make an impact, and that was, you know, incredibly exciting for us.
So you need to do several things. You need to find out what is known, and you said very little, apparently. You need to find out what you suspect are the various materials, chemicals, ingredients used in the fracking process, and then you've got to find the instrumentation in order for you to be able to go out and do an analysis, and that's not easy.
No, it wasn't easy, but you know, luckily one of the things I really like doing is going out networking and talking with people, and I seem to have a real enthusiasm for doing that, and people can sense that. So as soon as we determine what we need to look for, you know, these volatile organic compounds that are in the fracking process, these heavy metals, salt solutions, and we determined how we can measure for these, that's when we got in touch with Dr. Shug at University of Texas at Arlington and found out that he has all the analytical equipment, gas chromatography, liquid chromatography, mass spec, to do all these analysis. And then we also started collaborating with Geotech Environmental Equipment, and they provided us with the equipment to do the on-site basic water quality measurements, things like temperature and pH and salinity and total dissolved solids.
That was a gift, or was that part of sort of a business operation?
No, that was, I went and talked to a gentleman's name was Dan Hopkins at Geotech, and I described to him what we were doing, and he said, well, we would love to get involved with that, and so we're going to donate some equipment to you guys to use in the field. And so the same was done with a company called Assure Controls out of California, and they have a biotoxicity assay that we thought would kind of be a nice, like a canary in a coal mine, so to speak, where we could use this biotoxicity assay as a first line of analysis. And then if we see any toxicity response, then we'll do further characterization with the chemical analyses. As it turns out, you know, we did full basic water quality toxicology and advanced analytical chemistry on all the samples. But, you know, the whole process, you know, there were a number of players involved, and it was just a matter of networking and just sharing the enthusiasm for the project. And there were a number of people that wanted to get involved.
So then you've got everybody in place, you've got donated equipment, you've got in place equipment at UT Arlington, and presumably the legalities of using the state equipment are all taken care of in their right contracts, etc. How do you then go about setting up the design of the experiment? Because what are you going to test? Are you going to test before and after, or is it easy to test before and after, etc.? What was the design that you decided was appropriate for the exciting results that you've recently had and published, which we'll come to later?
Yes. Well, of course, I mean, ideally, to definitively identify whether this issue of hydraulic fracturing, whether it's having an effect on the groundwater, you would want to do before, during, and after samples, you know, to follow groundwater quality as a function of that hydraulic fracturing. Unfortunately, in the Barnett Shale, where we did our first sampling, you know, that opportunity wasn't available to us because we would have to have been collecting the samples back in 2000. And back then, the issue of hydraulic fracturing, no one really understood the process and no one really had a concern over it. And again, I wasn't doing science in 2000. So what we had is, our next best thing is we had some historical data that was available from the Texas Water Development Board. So that was kind of our preliminary baseline data, where they have a lot of metal concentration, salt concentration, and, you know, they had detections for some of these compounds like methanol and ethanol that we were looking for in our chemical analyses. But, you know, the next step upon, you know, having all the players in place was developing the study in terms of, well, how many samples do we need? Well, we determined we needed to have approximately 100 samples, and we needed to sample in and around, you know, the hydraulic fracturing at variable distances from the fracking sites, and we had to have a series of control sites. You know, we had to have some samples collected within the Barnett Shale formation that were outside of the natural gas extraction zone, meaning that they're about 15 kilometers, 20 kilometers from any fracking site. And then we also had to have some samples collected outside of the Barnett Shale where there's no historical hydraulic fracturing going on. So those would be our control samples.
You've set the scene. Now we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. We're talking with Dr. Zach Hildenbrand from Inform Environmental, LLC. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Ever think of how and when you're going to die, Dave?
After a 5-mile swim, lying under a palm tree at 120 years old.
Cross your fingers, because according to the world's top health organizations, fat chance. Their life expectancy chart ranked the U.S. 40th at 78 years old.
As you'd guess, geography is the biggest predictor of life expectancy. Japan and Switzerland top the list at 82 years, while the bottom two, Central African Republic and Lesotho, are at 46 years.
Education is a predictor, too. Men with bachelor's degrees live more than 9 years over those with a high school degree. For women, it's over 8.5 years longer.
So that suggests when, but how will it happen? We have the top 10 leading causes of death in the United States. Number 10 is suicide, which can be influenced by such factors as mental illness, genetics, drugs, and brain injuries. 9 is kidney disorders, and 8 is influenza and pneumonia.
Diabetes is 7th, and alarmingly, 1 in 500 children today are being diagnosed. Number 6 is Alzheimer's, and 5 is accidents that include car wrecks, accidental drug overdoses, and falls.
Number 4 is stroke, and number 3 are chronic lower respiratory diseases, many related to smoking. The top two, you guessed it, cancer and heart disease. Together, they kill 600,000 Americans a year.
The good news is the five-year survival rate from cancers has improved 15% in the past 30 years, and heart disease-related deaths have fallen by 18% in the past 10 years. Biomedical research is among the reasons why Americans are living longer and healthier lives.
So maybe my palm tree fantasy isn't such a stretch. We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Dr. Zach Hildenbrand from Inform Environmental, LLC, telling us about setting up the experiment that's going to see whether we can get scientific data that is credible about the impact of fracking in areas where water mainly comes from underground sources. Before we get into the results, tell us a little bit about the technique of fracking so that the audience can understand why there's a concern. What happens when someone comes into a region, my back garden, and says, hey, we want to dig a well and we want to try and find out if there's any hydrocarbon? How does it work?
Okay. Basically, we're talking about the unconventional extraction of natural gas. And basically what that covers is it covers hydraulic fracturing and also horizontal drilling. And so how the whole process works is you're drilling down, you're going vertical to, let's say, 2,000-3,000 meters, and you're pumping millions of gallons of water, proppant, which would be sand or silica beads, and also a milieu of chemicals in order to go down into these shale formations, which you can think of as, you know, beds of rock that have small, tiny little fissures or veins where this natural gas is trapped in. So basically, they shoot the water down with the proppant and the chemicals, and the sand gets lodged in these fissures, opens up these veins, and then now the natural gas seeps out, and then it goes up the annulus or the column of the drilling operation, and then they're able to collect it. This has been something that, hydraulic fracturing has been going on for, since the 1920s. But the recent discovery of these large shale formations where they can extract, tons of this natural gas and even oil in some instances has really been a game changer for this industry. And so, in addition to doing the hydraulic fracturing on a vertical plane, they've also doing it on a horizontal plane where, they go down thousands of meters vertically, and then they'll do a 90-degree angle, and they'll go right through the plane of the shale formation. And as you can imagine, by doing that, they have a greater surface area that they can extract the natural gas from. Now, the concern over hydraulic fracturing is, one, you're essentially penetrating down through the aquifer. The aquifer, that's going to be placed, let's say 100 meters below the surface, and you're having to penetrate through the aquifer, granted with many layers of protection of piping and cement, but you're penetrating through that aquifer to get down to the shale formation and extract the natural gas. The concern is, okay, are you putting natural gas into the aquifer? And are there instances where the chemicals used in the fracking process, are those leaching into the aquifer as well? Again, people use in Texas and Pennsylvania, California, using their aquifers not only for drinking water, but also to feed their cattle, agriculture. It's an incredibly valuable resource for these people. In many cases, it's their lifeblood, if we're talking about a farm. And so that's where the concerns lie. We've seen images, documentaries where, people's water is now flammable as a function of methane contamination. And, there's research showing that there's two types of methane. There's the biogenic methane that's produced by bacteria, and then there's the deep thermogenic methane, which they're looking for in these shale formations. And a large number of the instances where the water is flammable is because of this naturally occurring biogenic methane. But there are concerns over these chemicals, and we're talking about mainly the ones that people are concerned over are these BTEX compounds, and these are volatile organic. You're talking about benzene, you're talking about toluene, you're talking about ethylbenzene and xylene.
And all of these are part of the mix that goes down?
Yes, yes.
So tell us a little bit briefly, why would you do that? What's the efficacy of, say, benzene, a known carcinogen? What does that do that's useful in this process?
Well, they're using the chemistry down at thousands of meters. There's a lot of things going on. So they pump biocides. Glutaraldehyde, for example, is a biocide that they'll use. And then they have a whole bunch of anti-corrosive agents, things like methanol and ethanol that they'll put down there so that the piping doesn't corrode. Benzene, xylene, a lot of these they'll use as lubricants, gelling agents, surfactants, pH stabilizing buffers. There's essentially the list goes on. And
so it's a very sophisticated piece of chemistry.
Oh, it's very sophisticated, yes.
Let's cut to the quick here. What have you predominantly shown? You just recently had a very, very high-profile paper in a journal of the American Chemical Society. What was the finding that you found there, and what's been the response?
Okay, well, the finding was, again, we measured for 35 different compounds, these organic compounds, these volatile, semi-volatile, and we also looked at levels of heavy metals, arsenic, strontium, selenium, and barium. And we were not able to detect any of these BTEX compounds in the areas of hydraulic fracturing. However, we were able to find that in 29% of the samples collected in these hydraulic fracturing areas, 29% of the samples contain ethanol and methanol. And again, these are to some extent naturally occurring, methanol not as much as ethanol, but these are primarily used as anti-corrosive agents, and the concentrations that we found in many cases were indicative of an active source, meaning that they were likely coming from something that was introducing the methanol and ethanol into the system.
Because you had the samples here before and after fracking, or?
No, because with methanol and ethanol, they break down so rapidly to get concentrations of parts per million.
Okay.
Say 50, 60 parts per million, ethanol and methanol, that would likely be indicative of that there's something that's introducing that on a continual basis. And what we found is, again, all of these analyses were done in a geospatial context. So we were able to measure the concentrations of all of these analytes as a function of their proximity to the nearest gas well. And so with the ethanol and methanol, a majority of the larger concentrations were found nearest natural gas extraction sites.
Okay, that's a fingerprint in a sense. But do you have any data, published or unpublished yet, on the before and after concept, which seems to me the most compelling argument for saying, wait a minute, let's reconsider how we do this fracking. Not stopping it, but just reorganizing the methodology, perhaps.
Right. No, absolutely. Unfortunately, we didn't have that in this first study of the Barnett Shale, but we are actually doing that in the Cline Shale of West Texas, in and around the Sweetwater area, where we've gone.
Midwest Texas?
Well, yeah, the vernacular, I mean, to someone, you know, from Canada, I would say, well, that looks like Central Texas, but we've talked to a native Texan, they'll say, no, that's West Texas, and El Paso is far West Texas.
Okay, so, go ahead.
So we've gone into an area where natural gas extraction is just coming in. It seems to be the next big play in Texas. And so we've collected some baseline data before the fracking activity. We are now collecting data during the fracking activity where we can clearly see them, you know, doing the hydraulic fracturing and storing some of the chemicals in storage pits. And we've collected samples from these storage pits as well, which is going to be very, very interesting.
Right.
And then, again, we'll go ahead and do a third series of tests after the hydraulic fracturing. That's going to happen in about 8 months' time. And then we'll be able to look at that groundwater quality as a function of the evolving natural gas extraction.
There's a couple of points here. I mean, I'm ignorant on the process, but once you've sort of done the initial fracking, then you no longer need to keep pumping down vast numbers of gallons, millions of gallons of water. This is just to open up the initial well. Is that correct?
That's right.
Now, I was just recently in England and spent about 3 weeks over there doing various things. And the newspapers in England are full of this fracking. I'm calling it fracking. I know I'm supposed to call it fracturing or hydraulic fracturing. But
yeah.
Fracking is, we don't want your effing fracking. It's all over. It's all over England, I would say that. So it's a worldwide issue because it seems to be such a heavy source for hydrocarbon and clean hydrocarbon, mainly methane. So, I mean, are you beginning to get response to your initial paper?
you know, the response has been absolutely incredible. You know, if I may just go back a little bit, I mean, when we first did a press release calling for participants in our first study, we needed 100 participants.
Well, you needed volunteers, of course, to let you come to their property.
Yeah, we need volunteers to come on their property, perform water analysis for free, but we needed volunteers, and we needed about 100. And so UTA issued a press release for us, and we figured, well, maybe we'll get 100 after 3 or 4 months of really grinding this out. Well, we got over 1,000 phone calls and emails in the first 2 hours. you know, the response was absolutely phenomenal.
Right.
And so if we carry that over into, you know, the response after the publication, you know, we did 40, 50 interviews and informational conferences where we were telling not only reporters, we were telling groundwater conservation districts, municipalities, we were informing them about the results because everyone was incredibly concerned. So that's been nice in that, you know, we've done a piece of science where people actually care,
right,
and it seems to be having an impact.
Let me interject there, because we don't have a lot of time. But again, one of the comments that I saw, I think it was in the Times of London, for goodness sake, which is quite a staid newspaper, was saying that, well, of course, fracking will come to England, but it won't be, you know, with these cowboy drilling outfits that you see in the United States. What do you think that means?
Well, you know, I guess that in Europe they would see what's going on in the United States as the Wild West, in that, you know, hydraulic fracturing is not regulated. Just recently have they had to disclose what chemicals they use. You know, they can say that their chemicals are proprietary, so they can't list all of them. But it's not regulated as to the extent where you need to do baseline water testing before you do any hydraulic fracturing. You need to continually monitor the surrounding aquifers to make sure you're not having an effect. That seems, you know, common sense to me, but that's not the case. You don't have to do that. Now, there is some legislation going into California where they're very resistant to fracking right now, and the legislation states that you're going to have to do baseline testing to make sure that there's, so we can have a baseline of what the groundwater quality is, and then you're going to have to continually monitor that water to make sure you're not having an impact.
Right. So from your point of view, what you've found, your results, you're seeing some methanol, and the concentrations are a function of distance from wells and things like that. What do you see as the take-home message here, that the companies that are doing this are obviously taking note? And it seems to me that what you're doing is providing a service for those companies to say, hey, look, we'll modify the process a little.
Right. If I may, just in addition to the methanol and ethanol results, probably the most telling results that we found were the heavy metals. And we found that, as in most cases, you had instances of arsenic and strontium contamination as you got closer to hydraulic fracturing.
Hey, we've got to wrap it up. Zach Hildenbrand, Inform Environmental LLC in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Absolute pleasure talking to you again, and we'll do this again. We'll come back and do another program when you've got the data from West Texas, and look forward to that, okay?
Thank you very much, Keith.
Thank you. And thank you, Norma Martinez, the smile, the expertise, the ability to put the program together. We'll be back next week with another interesting program. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Ed Archuleta, former president of El Paso Water Utilities, has joined UTEP as Director of Water Initiatives. Archuleta, who is one of the country's top experts on water policy, will help position UTEP as a national resource for water-based education and research. Read more at the region's Life Sciences News Digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.